Thank you, John.
Okay. All right, so let's start. Let me summarize a couple of important things. So we discovered last time something very important, and which is we have a conceptual reason to try to understanding equilibration under unitary evolution. Reason being that conceptually the framework of an open quantum system is the story of the tortoise, right? So we need to understand equilibration in a closed quantum system. But if the quantum system is closed, then evolution is unitary. And if evolution is unitary, it doesn't reach an equilibrium state. Okay? And we have seen that the only thing that is compatible with quantum mechanics is to say that expectation values as a function of time, which are defined in this way, equilibrate in probability.
Alyosha, I think you zoomed on your screen because I think we can only see a half of it.
Huh.
Oh yeah, great, thank you.
Can you see everything now?
No, we still can't.
Huh. Okay, I don't know what you guys are seeing. Let me see.
I think that again. Your entire screen has zoom.
Sorry, Diana, can you see the entire screen?
No, I think all of the screen has zoom.
Okay, let me try again. Let me start over again using this very powerful technique that I just redo it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, now it's good. Yeah, it's good. Thank you.
Okay, now let me ask you something. What happens if now I do this? Do you still see? Okay. Because I'm trying to have on my iPad whatever I'm writing and on the laptop your faces. Okay. So we're saying the only thing that is left over is that A of t converges to A bar in probability, which, can you see now or not? Yeah, okay. Which yeah. Means something like this. Let me do this small plot here. This is A of t, it's a function of t. And after an initial transient period, it has very tiny fluctuations around some average value that is the value that we call a bar. And the situation that I just drew is something like saying the probability of when I observe over a very long interval of time of seeing A of t different from A bar more than epsilon is very small. So this is the only possible thing under unitary evolution. But if we can ensure that this happens, this is good enough. Because in the end, that's the only experiential content of quantum mechanics, are the observed values. Okay, so this was the first take-home message of last time. The other take-home message was that A bar is equal to the trace of A on phi bar. Phi bar being the time average over infinite time. And you have computed this as an exercise, and you have seen that phi bar, so let me just write the phi bar here, then you can plug it back in there, is equal to the initial state phi defaced in the basis of the Hamiltonian. So let me write the Hamiltonian here in this form that we have learned to understand. This one, this projector, is the projector onto the nth eigenstate. And basically, this operation, the operation that takes phi and gives us phi bar, is what we call DH, which means defacing in the basis of H. In other words, you have your initial state phi, which will have your populations phi 1, 1, phi n, n, and then all your off diagonal elements, phi k, l. You act with the DH, this is too long, this arrow. You act with DH, and you are left with just the populations. And this is zero here. So I have defaced, I've erased all the off-diagonal elements. I have defaced the coherences. Remember what are these phi an, nn. Phi kk is the probability of being in the state ek. Right? If you remember our initial formula, this probability is just phi ek modulus square, if we had started with the pure state. I would like to take questions right now before I go ahead, because I want all of this to be crystal clear. Any questions? Is this all clear? Any doubts, anything?
Phi kk is just one element of the diagonal, right?
Phi kk is one of the elements of the diagonal, right? So they're labeled by some k. Okay. All right. Another thing, so I'd left you with computing the Loschmidt-Echo. And in particular, we had found that the Loschmidt-Echo, so the Loschmidt-Echo defined as the overlap between phi and phi of t modulus square. And by the way, so this is the return probability, right? And you have made the computation, you've done this exercise, that the time average of this is equal to the trace of phi bar square, that I could even write as the trace of dh phi square, right? So it's the purity of dh phi. So the return probability is obtained like this. So I start with a state phi that has some diagonal elements that have the probability of being in a, of having a certain energy. but it's a coherent superposition, so it has off-diagonal elements. This could be also a non-pure state. Even a non-pure state may have off-diagonal elements. Okay? But for the sake of simplicity right now, think of it as a pure state. And now, as we said, we evolve it, and if I take the time average, I deface it, and only have the diagonal elements. And here it's zero. So if this one was pure, the purity, so the trace of phi squared would be
one.
After I do this operation, now look at it. The purity, so now this is phi bar, right? And the purity of this, the purity of phi bar is the sum of the squares of the diagonal elements, right? And now, is this pure or not? It's not pure, right? So, is there something fishy here? Because, you see, phi of t, which is the ingredient that entered here, is unitary. And I claim that something unitary will not change the purity. And now we are saying, hey, phi bar is not pure, the temporal average. So what's going on here? Is this a contradiction or not? So first of all, let's try to understand if mathematically this is a contradiction. And then let's try to understand physically what's going on so that we don't get lost in all these operations that we're making. What is the meaning of all of this? So let's start with the math, because math is easy. It's always physics that is complicated. So why mathematically there is no contradiction here? So the map that from phi gives you phi t is unitary. So definitely you guys have proven that if I take the purity of phi squared, this must be equal to the purity of phi t squared. So this must be true, right? Yes? You're raising your hand very high. You want to speak?
No,
you're stretching. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any idea what's going on here? Why the purity changed?
Because it's the average.
Very good. Because of the average. Okay. So the time average is not a unitary operation. Okay, so in no way I'm saying that this map, this is not unitary. Now, physically, what does it mean? This means that this state is not produced by our evolution, because our evolution only does this. So phi bar is not a physical state. It's not what is made by nature. So why am I summoning this state at all? Because somehow this is the whole point of this discussion. Why I'm using this state, somehow five bar, which is not a real state.
Maybe to get close to the like in the graph that you were drawing, that we had the average in
correct
the, right, that is
correct. So all I'm claiming is that these expectation values, that these are the real ones, which are obtained by this. And you see, this is the real one. Are close to those in phi bar. So even if phi bar does not exist, I'm saying this fictitious state gives us the right values, approximately. But if this approximation is very, very good, then the real value is indistinguishable from the fictitious value. Because what's happening is that this is the fictitious value and the real value is something like this. So we think we have equilibrated just because it's indistinguishable from something that has equilibrated. So now the point is, what ensures that these fluctuations, are they really small? So we don't know yet. We don't know this yet. Okay? All right. So we would like to understand that. We would like to understand what makes these fluctuations small. So this is a complicated subject, but I want you to learn this. Okay, so this is what we will be devoting this lecture and next lecture. I had this ambition that we would do a lot of quantum thermodynamics, but that was silly of me. But at least we really want to understand this equilibration business, which is, but it is the most important thing in statistical mechanics. How is it possible that the microscopic equations of the motion that are time reversal give us equilibration and thermalization, which has an arrow of time in the context of quantum mechanics? Okay. So the first thing that we would like to say is this. Since this average is the purity of this, this is what is on average the probability of going back to phi. It's given by this number. Now, question for you. Does this probability depend on the initial state phi or not? You can answer on either mathematical grounds or on physical grounds, whichever you prefer.
I have a question. Did you say that the probability of going back to the trace of phi is the trace of the square of phi?
Yeah, the probability of going back. So phi is the initial state. Phi of t is the state at the time t. And this overlap square is the probability that this state is equal to this state. So this is the probability that at the time t, we are back to the first state. And if I average, this is on average, what is the probability of this happening? On average, this is the time average, the bar is the time average. Because here, you know, I have some probability here. So if this is L of t, this is t, at the initial time zero, the probability of being in the initial state is one. And then I have some profile, right? Okay, and so this tells me what is the probability at this time, what is the probability at this other time, what is the probability at this other time. On average, what is this probability? Because definitely if we go back, if we have a high probability of being in the initial state, we definitely means we're away from equilibration. So this is what we would like to understand. What is this value? And we computed it's equal, so let me erase this, I don't need this. Remember, it's this, just the PM squared. So question, does this depend, this number, does this depend on the initial state or not?
I think
this question is not of a question to understand if you not understand the formalism. So who are the PNs? Are the diagonal element of phi. The diagonal elements of a density matrix in a given basis are the probabilities that your state is that basis element, right? So definitely, they depend on the initial state. They're just the probability that the initial state is in the eigenstate. So to give you, so if let's pretend it's pure, then this means that you can expand it in the basis of the energy, and Pn is the probability of being in the n squared state. If you write this as a density matrix, this is the diagonal element. A mathematical interlude. Since we have promoted the states from vectors to operators, and we like very much to use this inner product between states. Well, I would like to have an inner product between operators. So imagine I have two operators. I would like an inner product between, so let me put the hat here so that we know, oh, they are operators. I would like to have the inner product between the operators so that in the end, basically, I can always use the same notation, regardless whether I'm thinking of them as vectors, which mean, but that means I'm committing to the fact that they're pure, or as operators, which means I'm not committing to the fact they're pure, they're whatever they want, they're states. States, remember, are those objects that guarantee that the probabilities of what we observe are those that we observe. And that's the definition of state. It has to do with the nature, with what we observe. So we would like to do that. And mathematically, why should I even expect that linear operators should even have an inner product? Why am I so confident that they should have an inner product?
What do you mean with operators having an inner product? Isn't it the states that have the inner product?
No. But so let's really talk about operators, okay? Forget that they come from a state. Now I have two operators, two linear operators. And I'm claiming, oh, they have an inner product. And of course, you know, mathematical claims like this only make sense once I define what I mean. But why am I so confident that I'm gonna have a sensible definition such that I can actually use this notation? What's my line of thought? Why would linear operators even have an inner product? So you know inner product as an operation between vectors. Right? So you know that if you are in a linear space, you have vectors, and then you can define this operation. You know you can do that, right? But linear operators are vectors. This space is a vector space. The elements of the space of linear operators are vectors. Of course, in another space, they're not vectors in H. And why they are vectors? Because I can take linear combinations of them and I still have a linear operator. And this means to be a vector.
But are linear operators vectors or are vectors linear operators? Because
both.
You can both. Really?
Yeah, wow. So we have seen that from a vector, I can associate a linear operator in this way. So I should not say that vectors are linear operators. Actually, they are, because I can do an even better association. I can do this association. So this vector is a linear operator on the space H star, which is the space in which these objects live. So it's a linear map, not a linear operator, because you see, I take a psi and I get a number. How do I make it a linear operator? Okay, I do something like this. Now, this is a linear operator because this acts on some psi and gives me another bra vector, or it acts on some t and gives me another cat. So you see why cat bras are the objects that make, these are linear operators, and then combinations of them are linear operators. So that's why this is the general expression for a linear operator.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You ask why should we expect that there is an inner product on the space,
yes,
of operators, which I understand is the dual space. But
no, this is not the dual space.
Oh yeah, sorry, you know, you're right. That would be, yeah, that would be linear functionals. Yeah, but what I'm wondering is, you say because it's a vector space, we should expect that there is a sensible inner product, but is every vector space capable of being equipped with an inner product?
Yes, in a sense you can always define one. Yes, definitely.
Okay.
And the way we define it, so, and from now on, I will define it in this way. So now A and B are elements of BH, and BH is a linear space, so I can imagine writing it like this. But this is not a ket in H, it's a ket in B of H. And now I have to define this, and I define it in this way. And it's called Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. So every time you have linear operators, you can define this inner product. And you can check it as all the properties of the inner product, being bilinear and all of that, being positive semi-definite, or on the right vectors, and it's an inner product. So that's why a very convenient way of computing the Loschmidt echo, that remember is is this object. Is to use this expression. You don't need to use this, but it is faster if you use that. Okay, so this was a mathematical interlude, but let's go back to our problem. We would like to know what is the average of this object, which remember is given by this. So if the purity of the defaced state is very small, then the probability of returning to the initial state is very small. Right? This is what we're saying. And this probability.
Can you repeat that last thing again, please?
Oh, come again?
Can you repeat that last thing, please?
Okay, so this is the average return probability. Right? Because the argument of this average is the return probability. Is the probability that at time t we're back to the initial state, and I'm taking the time average, which means on average, what is this probability? On average on time, right? Remember, this is the time average. The bar is reserved to the time average. And we did this calculation, and we found out that the average return probability is the purity of the defaced state. You see, it's just the purity of, if you just take the diagonal elements squared, so it does depend on what is the initial state. So let's try to find a physical example in which the purity of the defaced state is not very small, which means that the return probability is kind of high. Can you help me out?
For a pure state?
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so imagine that your initial pure state, let's try. So your initial state is pure, so I can write it as a ket. And it is this state. Okay, so it is a superposition of the first two eigenstates of my Hamiltonian. And now, how do I write my Hamiltonian? My Hamiltonian will be equal. So let's compute now the log we take. So first I need phi of t. Phi of t is gonna be equal e to the minus I e1 t e1 over square root of 2 plus e to the minus I e2 t e2. Do you agree? And now let's take the overlap with the initial state. Okay. And okay, so let's see. We have this first overlap, right? Which is gonna be E to minus E E1 T over two plus E to the minus I E2 T over two. Do you agree? I substituted here this expression.
With the sole exception of the fact that you switched out your 0 and 1 for a 1 and 2, but sure.
Sorry?
The index of the E0 and E1 then converts into...
Oh, sorry. I know. You're right. And this is 0 and 1. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. What a mess. Okay, yeah, well, now you plot this function and you will see something like this. And this is not zero. And if you take the average, this average is 1/2, the time average. Just do that exercise. Well, I mean, you know that this average is 1/2. So you have 1/4 plus 1/4 is equal to 1/2. Well, so you see, definitely, this is not something that has a low probability return on average.
Can you please write down the name for this L that you write? Loschmidt.
Loschmidt.
Oh,
Loschmidt is the man who's responsible for Boltzmann's death. Because Boltzmann published this H theorem that says, hey, there is this quantity called H that is ever increasing. It's like the entropy. And I, you know, I can prove it. I could prove it from microscopic equations of the motion. And Loschmidt said, no, that's not possible. There is always a finite return probability to the initial configuration. If there is a finite return probability, then at some point this function has to decrease. Otherwise, how can it go back? And Boltzmann felt that he was very misunderstood and fell into depression and shot himself. So, well, this is, in some sense, it's a sad story, but it is also a beautiful story because it means that in the history of thought, we have high stakes. Okay, so it matters what we're thinking. You know? It's a question of life and death, in some sense. All right, so let's go back to our thing. Okay, so you see whether this object, which is the average return probability, which is this, is large or small depends on our initial choice. So, and we see from this formula very clearly how it depends. If I have only a few pn's, like in the example I did, I had a p and 1 minus p, right? They were 1 over square root of 2 and 1 over, sorry, they were 1 half and 1 half, right? The probability said 1 half probability of being in the state 0, 1 half probability of being in the state 1, and the two square probabilities were 1/4 and 1/4, and the sum of the two was 1 half. Or in general, you would, for whatever p, if you only have two states, you would have this. And this is not a small number, right? It's a number. Well, how can I make this number very small? If I have many of these, and they're all very similar, then they will all be around 1 over d. So you take 1 over, the square is 1 over d squared, you have a d of them. So you have d times d, so you have 1 over d, which is the minimum possible purity. And if your Hilbert space is very high dimensional, oh, then the return probability is very, very small. So we would like an initial state that is very spread out in the basis of the Hamiltonian. So here you have your answer. If your initial state is very spread out in the basis of the Hamiltonian, fine. Then you have a very low return probability. And if you have a very low return probability, maybe we're getting to what we mean by equilibration, maybe. Now my question is, in nature, how likely is this that my initial state is extremely spread out in the basis of the Hamiltonian? So, being this number super small is likely or not? So I pick some state phi, a random state in the Hilbert space. I look at the populations, Pn. Remember what these are. They are phi En square, the probability of being En. And I'm asking, are these probabilities very spread out? In the end. So this is the question.
I imagine in nature that's very likely to happen because there are just so many energy states possible in almost any natural system. As you yourself pointed out the other day, I mean, you said natural systems tend almost never to be degenerate. And they also, if they have a lot of particles, therefore have a lot of energy states.
So it is very likely that there are many of these, but I'm asking something slightly different. I'm asking that taking a state, how much this phi is spread out in this basis? Are you still claiming that it is very likely? Don't be intimidated. You can claim that. Let's see.
Yeah, I think so, but I'm trying to think why, or trying to think how to phrase why.
Yeah, so I agree. I have the same intuition, but I must say I do not have a very good argument.
Also, so, that implies that we have a state in a superposition of a lot of states, right?
Yes, this is what it means.
Of a lot of states. Is quite not very common in nature, I guess.
Okay, I'm very happy that we have someone else that has an opposite intuition. So this is exactly the problem. We have an Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian says, I have some special states, the eigenvectors, that define my energy. Means in this state, there is this energy. In this state, there is this energy. In this state, there is this energy. And now I take a random pure state that can I can always write, expand in this basis of the Hamiltonian. And as a superposition. And is this superposition very flat or not very flat? Typically. And here you have two colleagues of yours that have opposite intuitions. And I have to say, I slightly favor the first intuition, but I do not have a super good argument. So this is one of those questions that should be settled mathematically. So let's settle it mathematically. Okay. So what we're gonna do is this, is that we pick a state, random, we erase, remember, this is what we want to compute. This one, right? The purity when you erase the diagonal, the off-diagonal elements. So you only take the diagonal elements, you square them, because this is this, and you sum them. Okay, so you take a state, you compute this, which we learned should be expressed in this way. So this is phi bar, right? Now I square it, and I take the state. And now I do it for every phi, and I want to know, on average, for averaging over all the phi's, what we get. So what I'm trying to say is that I take a phi, so I deface it, I square it, I compute the trace, and then I take another phi and compute the same thing, I sum, and so on and so forth. I take the average, which I would like to express in this way. This is the average provided that whatever this integral means is normalized, right? That this measure is a normalized measure. So learning to take these integrals is a beautiful topic in mathematical physics, and it's called Haar measure. I do not have the time to teach you Haar measure, I will just give you a result that we will be using. But it's a beautiful topic because the way we learn how to take these integrals is not by learning how to integrate, but to use group theory actually. And that it's a theorem that has very, basically it descends from Schur's lemma, and it has very profound consequences on the meaning of what it means to make a measurement also. But that's a topic for another, you know, set of lectures. But this is what we want to do, right? We want to do the Haar measure, and this integral, I will denote it in this way, the average over the phi's. Now, so the object that we want to compute is this. Now we have the square, and we have the average over the phi's. And now we have a big problem, because what, you know, computing this is very easy. In fact, one can easily prove, I have to skip the proof, but one can easily prove that the average state is the completely mixed state. It kind of makes sense, right? It means I have a probability 1 over d of being in any state in my hyperspace. It's the what in statistics is called the microcanonical ensemble. That's the average state. So what I would really, really, really like to do is to say that this is equal to the trace of dH, the average of phi squared. This is what I would like to do. Because then I would be done, right? Then I plug in this result and I'm finished. Do you think I can do that?
But the average give us like a number, right? A constant.
And no, this average gives us an operator. Well, in this case, this gives us, my bad. This is a number, yes, because in the end, because this is a number and the average of numbers is a number. Yeah, correct. This average is an operator because this is not a number. This operator plus this operator plus this operators, and you take all the states in the Hilbert space. So it's an operator.
And also it's a linear operator, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And also this guy, that's a very good line of thought. Also this guy is a linear operator, dH. dH of two states is equal to dH of sigma plus dH. So can I do this? So I can do it if everything is linear. Is everything linear here?
Wait, I have a question. But also the definition that you used there, the average over phi is also an operator or is a state?
This thing?
Yes. This
is an operator.
The phi.
Let's say that we start, for the sake of simplicity, let's say that our initial state is pure.
But I mean, I can use that definition as a phi and operator, so I can use that definition on the defacing, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm treating states as operators always.
Okay, thank you.
So somebody, I heard somebody from the invisible ones that said the word square.
No, that was me. I said, yeah, there's a square of the operator, so we can't pull the integral inside the square in general.
Yes, right. So that's the most important thing in nature, that the expectation value of x squared is not expectation value of x squared. If this were true, nothing would ever happen, ever. So the whole point of nature is that the average is not representative of what you typically observe. At the very least, you have to look at the variances, especially when you make claims on viruses. At the very least. Okay, so what do we do? Okay, so luckily, so our problem was the square, right? Luckily, because what we're trying to do, so remember, this is a state, right? This is the state that we are squaring. Let me call it, just to simplify slightly the notation, let me call this state, let me call it omega. So what we want to compute is the trace of omega squared, and then I average over the phis, right? Omega depends on phi. If I had to be a stickler, I should put this, but I claimed I wanted to make the notation lighter. Okay. And I cannot do this. I cannot do this. Remember though, so let me get rid of the average for a second, then I will put it back. We learned the trick to compute this. What is the trick? Can you help me out? And now you will see why the trick is so important, exactly in this context.
Is that related to the inversion operator?
Mm-hmm. We learn that this is equal to the trace of this T2 operator, the swap operator, over two copies of omega. And now let's appreciate the math of this. This operation is nonlinear, right? The squaring. But in here, everything is linear. This is a linear operation. This is a linear operation. This is a linear operation. This is in general true. You can always, by increasing the register in which you put your information, linearize an operation. This is what computers do. That's how computers take squares at the very, very basic level of logical operations. Now that we see this, now you see that whatever is this expectation value that you're taking, well, then it's this expectation value that you're taking. But now everything is linear, so this is, it goes to the trace and it goes to this. So this is the trace of T2 over the average of omega tensor 2. Let me take one more page. So we are saying that the average of trace omega square is the trace of T2 over the average of omega tensor 2. And remember what is omega. Omega is dh phi tensor 2. But also dh is linear. So trace T2 dh tensor 2 over the average of phi tensor 2. Oh, so you see, if I know to take the average of two copies of the state, then I just plug this one in because I've linearized everything and I'm done. Now, this is where I will use a result from Haar measure. Because this is, this is the integral, right? An expectation value is a sum, it's an integral. It's a measured thing. So this is the result that I give you. So this is a result that comes from group theory that I would love to teach you one day, but right now let's use the result. This is equal to the identity on two copies of the Hilbert space. Remember, you see, this is two. This is your initial state tensor itself. Plus this operator. Not surprising, this operator also acts on this space. Remember, it's the swap operator. It acts on two copies of the space. Over the dimension of the space times d plus one. So exercise for you, compute the average purity of the defaced state, which means plug this operator back into this formula and do that. So this is an exercise in using these, all these operators and operators of operators. And you see how powerful all these formulas that we are learning to use in terms of, you know, it's all linear algebra in the end. And we will have a beautiful statistical result that is, what is the average purity of a state after you erase the off-diagonal elements? And the answer is, two over d plus one. You have to find this. But this is an amazing result. It's saying that on average, in a high-dimensional Hilbert space, if this very large, which is typically the case in nature because you have many particles, the average purity of the defaced state, which means on average how it is spread, goes like 2 over d. But this is basically infinite. Imagine that you have a system of 100 spins one half, then this 2 to the 100. And this number is kind of small. Right? Just 100 particles. Of course, in nature, there are typically, when we observe something, there are 10 to the 23 particles every time we have something macroscopic. And these 10 to the 23 particles do not have only two states. So the basis is not two, but it's cube, some number cube. So this is the mathematical answer to this question. How spread are quantum states in the Hilbert space? Unless it's a microscopic system, on average, a lot. And you need to compute this. So I think this is, so let me see what are the problems that I gave. So if we look at, this is problem 2.1. Skip problem 2.2. I don't want you to do that anymore. And tomorrow Thursday, we will do together. But you can try to also try to do 2.3. So 2.3 is a generalization of problem 2.2. And we will look at that result together on Thursday. But okay, so 2.1 and 2.3. You skip 2.2. All right, so I think it's a good moment right now to go into the break rooms.
Sorry, could I ask you just to very quickly show the results of that hard?
Absolutely. Yep.
No, sorry, I just asked if you could show the result of that Haar measure average one more time.
Two over d plus one. Oh, you mean the result on the state?
Yes, you had a result of the average of phi to the tensor 2.
Yeah, so it is a question 6. Oh, no, I didn't put it in the... Sorry, you're right. Okay, let me show it to you guys.
Thank you.
You're very right. I thought I put it in the... So let me rewrite it so that it's very clear. So, sorry about that. Okay, share screen. Okay. So this is the basic element is, if I take two copies of the states and I take the expectation values over all the initial pure states. Can you see my screen?
Not currently, no.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, it just appeared. All right.
Okay, is it clear?
Yes.
Okay. This is equal to two copies of the identity plus the swap operator over d times d plus 1. So this is what you have to use in that expression.
Okay, thank you.
Wonderful. So let's go to the break rooms.
Okay, so I'll assign. Are there more questions?
Which problems we have to solve again, sorry?
2.1 and 2.3, but 2.3 you have to do, you know, it's a kind of a take-home problem. And by home, I mean, you try to work it out together in the groups. And then Thursday, when we start the lecture, you know, we will address that problem. So you tell me, oh, this was not clear, this was not clear. But right now in the break rooms, let's just work on 2.1.
Okay, thank you.
Clarify that this is the same problem set that we had last time. So there is no new file on Slack. Okay, so I'll assign everyone.
Problem set, it's the same problem.
Yeah.